How's it going, everybody? Thank you for coming in. It's right after lunch, so hopefully we got our energy back and we're ready to sit through something. So I want to introduce a friend of mine, Jacqueline Burt. A recent friend of mine through this process. She is, you can't unhear this, the human embodiment of a golden retriever. And I say that because of energy. You will feel it. Whenever we're on Zoom, it's like one of the most entertaining, fun conversations you could have. But as you know, through this description, reflective practice is turning that mirror on yourself. And I do a lot of work in wellness, and this conversation, to me, is pivotal, not just in the DEI field, but for yourself and fulfillment and the ability to thrive. And so I am super excited for this, and I think it is something that the beer industry is ready to start having more conversations, more conversations like this. So without further ado, Jacqueline, come on up.
Thank you. Okay. I almost, as you were talking, I was like, don't oversell. Like, I'm not that cool. Can we all hear me okay? Can I see, like, thumbs maybe? Yeah? Okay. Outstanding. I'm wondering, too, I want folks to be able to trickle in, but was also told by our wonderful AV folks that closing this far door here is also going to be helpful. So maybe, come on in. You're welcome. Awesome. Cool. Okay. Door is closing. Thank you so much. Lock it. No passwords. Cool. Okay. Well, thank you all so much for being here. I am really excited to be here myself. As Damon very generously introduced me, my name is Jacqueline. Really excited to be talking to you all today about reflective practice. It probably was not in the description of this particular talk, but part of what goes along with this as well is actually some pretty concrete adaptive communication skills and strategies. I myself am not in the beer and brewing industry, but certainly communication is a skill that extends across all industries and is important for just like being a person. So hopefully that will be valuable for you all today. I'm going to use the mouse as instructed to advance the slides, at least in theory. There we go. So, okay, reflective practice. To kick off here, this is a quote that I often will use when I give this content, and that is, I'm not as concerned with changing my thoughts as I am with changing my relationship to my thoughts. Thoughts, apparently, double thoughts. But relationship to thoughts is part of what is key here. I will say a lot of this content is actually coming from a class that I teach to undergraduate students primarily. The way that I like to do this content with students is to, instead of doing kind of a content dump and then questions at the end, I will encourage you all to ask questions throughout. So if something feels kind of fuzzy or you would like an additional piece of clarification or an example, throw up a hand, yell it out, cut me off, whatever you gotta do. But questions can be in the midst of content. So, continuing, setting some intention, expectation for the content. So, this workshop design, we will learn about reflective practice. Pure curiosity, so I can kind of get a sense of what we're rocking with. Can somebody or anybody throw up a hand if reflective practice is familiar at all? Does that ring? Oh, I see some. Okay. Exciting. Okay, there's the golden retriever. Did you hear it? Okay, cool. Well, we will learn a little bit more about it for folks who are not as familiar about reflective practice as a framework and tool. And as mentioned, discovering more about adaptive communication and its connection to reflective practice. Making connections between reflective practice, your identities and experiences, and how you communicate in your work and professional relationships. Again, valuable, relevant for everybody. And ideally, if all goes according to plan, leaving with a handful at least a few, of strategies or takeaways for incorporating reflective practice into future goals, both personal and professional. And that's the intention. I will note as well, so a lot of the content here is mine, something that I have developed over my own professions, but a lot of the ideas and a lot of the other work comes from the three professionals listed here. So Adrienne Marie Brown, Sonia Renee Taylor, and Jennifer York Barr are all leadership and or education professionals. Big believer in giving credit where credit is due. Work is never not just our own. So those are folks that you can look into more if this content interests you in particular. So a little bit about me. There's me. Jacqueline, as mentioned, I do use she and her pronouns. So background, got a couple different things going on. First Looks LLC is the name of my business. Primarily, I work in the wedding industry. So First Looks LLC serves the wedding industry here in the Twin Cities, around the country, really, but mostly here. My undergraduate degree is in business marketing, of all things. And I have a graduate degree, a master's of education, in leadership and identity development. And between both of those two degrees, I work in two different industries. So the day job side, I do work in higher education here at the University of Minnesota, actually. I'm a student counselor, student academic advisor, and student instructor. So do education and counseling with college students. It's as fun as it sounds. And then also, as mentioned, working in the wedding industry, I am a makeup artist by training and profession. With the counseling background, I do also do what we just call emotional support services. And so I actually work with folks on the emotional pieces of planning a wedding. I don't know if anyone here has planned a wedding medium recently or knows someone who has. Emotions get real intense real fast. So I blend, get it, makeup joke. Anyway, cool, thank you. Blend those two experiences into those services. So that's me a little bit more. Some grounding. I know we've already gone through various grounding bits. This is a big one for me. And that is that we never really understand something until we can create a model or metaphor out of our own unique personal world. The reality we perceive, feel, see, and hear is influenced by reflection. And I love this bit at the bottom. Humans don't get ideas, they make ideas. Spontaneously, what I would love, with the folks at your table, whether you are strangers or not, take like 30 Mississippis. What does this bring up for you? Ready, go. Okay, clap once if you can hear me. Clap twice if you can hear me. Clap three times if you can hear me. Amazing. I also was raised by a preschool music teacher. Sometimes it shows up like that. Also used to coach third graders in after-school running, so that works really well if you're eight. Okay. Awesome. Heard a lot of cool conversation going on. Hopefully you also got to know the folks at your table a little bit. But grounding for reflective practice. I did see a few hands go up when I asked if there was some familiarity with this term slash concept. Let's make it a little more concrete. So what is reflective practice? What do I mean by that? And essentially, it's just a method of thinking and behaving. It's a way to be learning continuously. As you might imagine, the reflective piece is really key in reflective practice. This is really about being able to have self-awareness, have neutral self-awareness is the key, right? No self-judgment or self-analysis, more of like a self-observation. So clearly recognizing our mental models, I'll go into what those are a little bit more as well, that are shaping our thoughts and behaviors, both consciously and unconsciously. And engaging with reflective practice, some examples, it can invite conscious thoughts and feelings to a more conscious surface. Certainly, it offers opportunities for a lot clearer choice and connection making, very helpful, leading to more informed action instead of maybe automatic following of unexamined norms and beliefs, so more informed decision making and choice making as well. And importantly, or my favorite anyway, developing our adaptive communication skills, importantly, clarity, caring, conscientiousness. So that's a lot of content. If it's feeling kind of meta right now, that's because it is. Are there any bits that feel especially fuzzy at this point? Are we kind of digesting? Literally and figuratively? Cool. Okay. Keep cruising for now. So reflective practice can look like, again, getting a little more concrete, so thinking about our thoughts, aka metacognition, thinking about our thoughts, and having an internal dialogue before, during, and after an event. An event can mean an event like this, right? This is an event. An event can be a conversation. It can be a dream that we have, right? So thinking about our thoughts, thoughts about thoughts. Connecting new information to previous learning and understanding, so making connections. Applying insights to contexts and situations beyond the one in which they were first learned or experienced. So an example might be, you could learn about reflective practice today, and then you are engaging in reflection, reflective practice, if you take some of this juice and apply it to your work. That's reflective practice. And considering how our mental models might be influencing thoughts, behaviors, and interactions with others. Self-awareness, if I had to sum it up in like one term, right? This is like a cooler, more meta version of self-awareness. I'm seeing nods. Okay, outstanding. So mental models. Can I see hands if we're familiar with that maybe? We've heard it before. I'm seeing some people. Yeah? Okay. So what I mean when I'm delivering this content about what mental models are, how they work. So they are held internal ideas of how the world works, or at least maybe how we think we should have the world work, how we want it to work. And they keep us in familiar ways of thinking and acting. I will note, particularly when I deliver this seminar to undergraduate students, things can sometimes get a little bit fuzzy when it comes to distinguishing between mental models and personality. So importantly, our mental models can inform what our personality is. They influence our personality, but they are a little bit separate. Mental models, I like to think of almost as a kaleidoscope in terms of it's lots of parts and pieces of our lives so far, our identities, our experiences, our relationships, informing our personality, but operating as well. It's not just something that exists, it's something that operates, if that makes sense. The operational piece is really key. They are continuously developing. Mental models are not static. So they develop with stuff that happens to us. Shifts in identities, experiences, relationships, right? This definitely applies when I'm working with wedding clients. If you were a single person and then you get married and now you're a married person, that's a pretty significant identity shift, and it will inform your mental models. We are often not conscious of our mental models. This is important. Certainly, we might be aware that we have them. We maybe will describe them as our values or even our politics. But again, with that functionality piece, being aware of how that mental model is influencing our behavior, our conscious and unconscious thoughts and behaviors, and then how they are impacting folks around us and our relationships with them. And that's what reflective practice is good for, is making some of that more conscious, since we are often not. And then again, some specifics. So mental models influence things like whether and to what extent we might feel comfortable in any given environment, how we gather, interpret, and respond to information, whether, how, and with whom we then share that information, communicate, and then how we respond to various stimuli across contexts, which is an unnecessarily nerdy way of saying how we react to things. Cool. Fuzziness at this point. Is it making sense? Ish? Yes? I see more nods. Awesome. I'm going to do another quick break. What I would love this time is maybe turn to folks at your table, and if anything feels especially interesting at this point, or like, ooh, I want to know more about potentially that, share it out. Ready, go. I'll have you start to wrap up and bring it back. I won't make you clap again. Coming back to the large group. Take it back now, y'all. One hop, two hops, cha-cha slide. Nobody? Ugh, do I work in the wedding industry or what? Line dances. Okay. Amazing. Really awesome to see everybody having some cool conversations. When I teach this class, usually with undergrads, it's a night class, which was a terrible idea. And so getting them to talk to each other is much more challenging. So thank you. We will keep moving. So some important things about mental models. I briefly mentioned neutrality earlier. So these are two big chunks. So first, we do not analyze, try to fix, or otherwise judge our mental models. There's a difference between thinking about what mental models are, and then I had mentioned earlier, too, how something is functioning. So your mental model is what it is, right? I cannot get away from being myself. But I can think about how my mental model is impacting my behavior in the world. So mental models are not to be fixed or analyzed. They are just to be explored and examined. That description under there, right, investigating whether or how they might be keeping us stuck, causing us to behave in ways that are maybe not awesome or things that we don't want to continue to do or participate in. But no analysis, no judgment. And importantly, then, too, mental models are neither right nor wrong, right? The models themselves, neither right nor wrong. These are just maps for, again, exploring how we are showing up in the world, at work, in our relationships, the stuff that matters to us, and then how our views may or may not have been and are being, right, continuous, shaped and influenced. Okay. A little bit more linking some things. So mental models and reflective practice. This diagram might be familiar to some folks. Sometimes it's called an identity wheel. Sometimes it's called social identity circles. All very similar concepts. Is this looking familiar to anybody or like a version of this maybe? Identity circles? Okay, cool. So sometimes that centermost circle in this particular diagram, it's called personality. Sometimes it will just say self. But the idea being that who we are is influenced by all sorts of stuff. The elements that are in that internal ring, for the most part, are things that are not likely changeable. So things like our race and ethnicity, our age, our gender potentially, right? Those things tend to be more static. And then as you move further out in the circle, that's where things get more dynamic. When it comes to mental models and reflective practice, so social identities, of course, are a really important way of how we show up, how our mental models are developing and functioning. And so going back to this functionality piece, our identities, whatever they are, aren't just things that are, they are things that function. There's movement, right? It's impacting and influencing our thoughts and behaviors. And understanding that functionality piece is a really important part of reflective practice. So the example there, of course, someone with privileged identities is going to have a totally different mental model of the world than maybe someone with different identities. And so rather than criticizing or rejecting those identities, again, no judgment, no analysis, we have the ability with reflective practice to hold what those identities are and then also examine how they're working or functioning simultaneously. That's the juice. So the communication pieces, reflective practice and adaptive communication. Have we heard adaptive communication maybe? Kinda, yes? Nods. The nods are getting a little more slow motion. I like it. So information and communication are two terms that are often used interchangeably, but they signify quite different things. This is Sydney Harris, by the way. Information is giving out, and communication is getting through. So I don't know if in the workplace or even in your personal relationships, if you've ever had a conversation or even like an email exchange where you might both be saying English words and you are not saying the same thing. I see a lot more nods for that. Yes, right? Me, every day. Yes. So communication and reflective practice is where things get really interesting. So some components of communication, this is kind of human communication theory 101. We're going to have a lot of C's going on. This particular diagram, the four C's of communication, so we have caring, or how we deepen relationships, commitment, or how we follow up and through and up, consistency, so how we convey and reinforce our messages, sometimes also called reliability. And then clarity, or how we are avoiding ambiguity and misunderstanding. maybe the last time that I'll have you do this, but no promises. What I would like for this prompt, actually, you're all at your tables. I don't want to make you move your bodies, but maybe just in pairs. So instead of trying to do the whole table, pair up with somebody near you. Which C of communication do you think you would like to improve upon the most, given what you know at this point? Ready, go. We'll take a few more moments to wrap up your thoughts. We'll start to bring it back. Outstanding. We're coming back. Awesome. Cool. Okay. Thank you all for continuing to engage with each other. I heard the volume is really different each time, so that's extra interesting for me up here. What I did not name, so that center circle, trust, right? Part of the idea with this communication theory is that when all four of these particular C's are operating as intended, trust can then grow. Another seminar that I sometimes give, again, primarily to undergrads, is actually the difference between affective and cognitive trust. I'm bringing it up because it might be especially relevant to professional settings. Affective trust, in this context of communication, affective trust means I trust that the person in front of me is a quote-unquote good person, right? Or I know that the person in front of me likes me, at least a medium amount, right? Affective trust, I trust that you're doing the best you can. Cognitive trust often means I trust that you are competent or capable. So I know I have been in professional settings where I maybe know that the colleague in front of me and I don't necessarily vibe. We probably wouldn't be friends outside of the workplace, but I do know that they trust me to do my job, right? So there might be cognitive trust going on and not necessarily affective trust. Also have been in situations where there's stuff going the other way around, right? I know that maybe I really like somebody, they really like me, but like sometimes they mess up a lot and I don't know how to tell them because we're friends, right? That would be high affective trust and not as high cognitive trust. That's another talk. Go to my website for more. Anyway, what I'm going to do with reflective practice is add two more C's. So in this graphic, the two additional C's are curiosity and consent. If you're like me, consent is probably something that you maybe think about in the context of like sex education, and that might be where our brains go when we think about consent. And that is definitely important. In the context of communication, consent has to do with how we are actually making word and language and communication choices when we are communicating with others. So I'll give some very specific examples here in a moment. First, want to note the connection. So reflective practice is really rooted in checking assumptions, and then asking good questions. And so it allows us then to add those two additional C's, curiosity and consent, into the other communication components. So curiosity, the way we have it lined out here, it's the desire to learn or understand, and then importantly, being open to lots of possibilities. When we know that we have mental models, we also know that other humans have mental models. So being open to multiple different possibilities or takes on a situation, that's a big part of curiosity in communication. And consent, again, agreeing or giving permission to or for something. The curiosity piece is really interesting when it comes to language in particular. For my own curiosity, we can do another quick show of hands. Does anyone speak a language in addition to or other than English, or have like working knowledge of another language other than English? Okay, cool. Me too. Awesome. Part of why I'm bringing that up, or why I'm thinking of it, so fun fact, English, American English as a language, is one of the least syntactically curious languages. We're getting real nerdy for a second. Okay, hang on. Not as much natural curiosity in the language. What I mean by that is that American English is a very declarative language. We tend to value statements, right? I think this is me. And really statement-shaped languages and phrases. We tend to hear a lot of certainty expressed in American English, right? We have a natural kind of linguistic revulsion to words like may or could or would or maybe, right? That then gets read as like wishy-washy. That's not true in all world languages. So it's especially interesting if I'm thinking about languages and mental models. American English is shaped much more declaratively, and reflective practice is a way of bringing some of that possibility and curiosity piece back in. Fun facts, I'm full of them. Okay, specific bits. So reflective practice redesign, there are three tools. If you walk away with anything from today, this is what I think is perhaps the juiciest. Three specific things that we can do to put curiosity and consent into our communication. So those three things, using what I call possibility prompts, more on that in a sec, not being afraid of yes or no questions. If anyone has ever taken like a communications class or a business class even, I know I was taught that yes or no questions can shut down a conversation. Anybody else? Right? Yes or no questions are ineffective. That's not true, or at least it doesn't have to be true with reflective practice. And then offering simple and small choices. So some specific examples of what is meant by each of these things, we have three different question makeovers or sentence makeovers. So example one, a question that I might ask of a peer or a colleague or a student, maybe just like, what are you struggling with? And I want to be clear, too, the examples of the sentences and questions on the left are not wrong or bad, and if you speak and communicate this way, great, you may very well get the results that you are seeking. So if I say to a student of mine, what are you struggling with? They could totally tell me. If I'm trying to have a little more consent and a little more consent and curiosity in my language, an option for a little makeover might be, could you tell me a bit more about your experiences with this so far? It's teeny, right? Not a huge makeover. This is not extreme home makeover. But adding words like could and would and can and may, what it actually does in the brain, here's some psych, ready? It opens up how your brain is understanding language. So I can totally say, what are you struggling with? If I say, could you tell me a little bit more about your experiences with this so far? Technically, that's a yes or no question, right? I call these yes invitations. So it's a yes or no question, but by using a word like could, it's actually inviting the person in front of me to share, right, what their experiences might be like. So that's a yes invitation. Example two, why don't you show me what you've done up to this point? Again, totally cool, totally generous, totally great way to ask somebody a question. If I give it a little bit of a makeover, I might say, this is an example of simple and small choice, by the way. Would it feel helpful if I look at what you've already done, or would you prefer looking it over on your own first? Consent, right? I'm asking the person in front of me, giving them a small choice. Sometimes giving just two little baby choices can calm down a brain as well. If I'm in a stressful situation, if we're maybe on a project deadline, and so I know that stress responses might be like a little bit higher, giving the other person small choices is an opportunity for power and autonomy, right? Then they get to make a choice for how they want to move forward. Are we with me so far? I'm seeing nods. Yeah? Okay, cool. Last example. So I don't know if I understand what you mean, right? This one isn't a question, it's more of a statement. And this would be a really thoughtful thing to say to somebody, right? Maybe you're in conversation or maybe you're emailing and you can say like, I'm not sure I understand. Great, gorgeous. The makeover has a couple pieces going on. There's a reiteration of your intent, and then also a more consent and curious way to ask a question. So we might say, I want to make sure I'm understanding you, right? Reiterating your own intention. Could I tell you what I'm hearing, and you can let me know if that's what you mean? Can we see or hear the consent there, right? Giving the other person the opportunity to self-correct or come up with their own. Part of what's really helpful is giving, again, whoever we're communicating with, power, right? It's a gesture of respect to put consent back into our language choices. This is really complex, I know, or at least I think it is. Last time, I'll have y'all talk to each other. No specific prompts, but at your table, how is this landing? What's coming up? We'll take about a minute. Ready, go. We're going to start to bring it back. I know this is really juicy. We're going to bring it back. Coming back to the large group. Thank you. Thank you. We're bringing it back. Time always goes really quickly, so I want to make sure we get through the last couple pieces. But yeah, this is juicy stuff. What I want to introduce next are, it's really more of a wrap-up on this than introduction per se, but I call them golden questions, maybe in part because I am an instructor and advisor at the University of Minnesota. Go Gophers, right? Anybody? No? Go, 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 Gophers. Yes, okay. Golden Gophers, right? Golden questions. Two golden questions. So these are questions that I go back to again and again in terms of whenever I can ask them or a version of them, especially in a project-oriented or particularly challenging conversation, smooths things out, helps things go a lot more comfortably. So golden question number one, what do you need from me in order to blank? Right? Have a good experience in this job. Feel good about moving forward. Make a decision. Feel seen, understood, heard, safe, supported. I can't remember all the options I have up there. But, right? What do you need from me in order to blank? Part of what is cool about this is that it keeps it personal. I will often talk with students and clients about any time you can personalize your communication, reflective practice, right? Mental models. It's cool. You're acknowledging that you are one human and that you have a personal role in what's going on. So what do you need from me can be really helpful. It gives the other person the opportunity to say, like, you're good. I got to talk to somebody else, right? Ooh, I see a question from Damon. What's up?
In order to create a space like that for somebody to offer up what their needs are, what is needed?
Yeah, that's a great question. So Damon had asked, in order to have this question be effective and create space for somebody to even answer this question, what's needed? The answer is a lot of reflective practice, a lot of adaptive communication already going on. I'll say maybe importantly, this is something that takes some time to develop. Certainly, like when I first meet a new student and they're a brand new baby undergrad and they have never met me before and I say, what do you need for me in order to blank? They say, I don't know. You're a stranger, right? So the person in front of you isn't always going to have an answer to the question. What we know is that even the gesture of making the ask can be really valuable. I'll sometimes also say to folks whenever I use this question, I'll even name, like, you may not have an answer right now, but what might you need for me in order to blank, right? So giving some space around, like, you maybe don't know, but if something occurs to you later today or later this week or in a couple weeks, right? Anytime, I do a lot of this motion, if you haven't picked up on it, anytime we can expand and open up our word choice, that can be really helpful. Which brings me to actually the second golden question, and that is, how can I be helpful for you right now? Or version two, is there a way I can be helpful for you right now? Right, because even the first version of that question you're maybe picking up assumes that there's a way I can be helpful for whoever's in front of me. And again, might not be me. They might say, you're cool. I don't think there's anything you can do, but I have to go talk to this person. When I ask this question too, there are a couple key pieces. So asking again the personalization, how can I be helpful or is there a way I can be helpful? What I really like about this golden question as well is that we have that piece of right now. Meaning, say somebody has sent me an email and they want to talk about a particular topic. And that email is sent and they say, I want to talk on Thursday. Can we talk on Thursday? And it's Monday. I say, cool, sounds good. Stuff can happen, between like a Monday and a Thursday. So even if I know that we're going to get together to potentially talk about that thing, I will still ask this question, because when I say, how can I help right now, it acknowledges that stuff might have happened or changed, right? What's going on now? What would be useful now? What would feel comfortable now? Golden questions. So moving forward, and then we've got a few more minutes for questions. So reflective practice is, at its heart, a liberation practice. Excuse me, we're going to sip water for just a second. There we go. A liberation practice. That's what reflective practice is. So some benefits, in case this was not already apparent and evident. So a greater tolerance for ambiguity is a really key part. Greater tolerance for what are sometimes called multi-truths, or quote-unquote opposite things being true at the same time. It's often uncomfortable, it's supposed to be, but it's also a really common part of being a person. Increased patience for healthy conflict and disagreement, also something that happens all the time. The biggest thing that I find helpful about reflective practice and some of these adaptive communication strategies is that it makes conflict something that is just happening. Conflict is a function, right? It doesn't have to be inherently a problem. Increased ability to think systemically. That goes back to mental models, right? Kaleidoscopes. There's a lot going on. Can I hold a couple different things at the same time? Much more open and adaptive communication. And the ability to actually identify and name expectations and needs with more compassion and care. I will often say to my undergrads things like, I can only meet expectations that I know about. Right? I can only meet expectations that I know about and that I have the tools and capacity for. Right? Lots of stuff going on there. So being able to identify expectations and needs and then bring that into communication, that's a big one. But I think that is it for content. Thank you all for all of your engagement and your patience, really, all the small group chats. I believe we have a few minutes yet for some questions, if we got them. But that's it for content. Many thanks. Applause. Thanks. Thank you. Too nice. Are there questions, comments, bits that feel fuzzy? I see a couple of hands. Let's go. I saw you. Go for it. Excuse me. Go for it. Go Gophers. Yeah. Yeah, so modeling. If I'm understanding your question, what I'm hearing is, when there's an established work relationship, how can I have those ambiguous questions actually be answered honestly? Is that what you were asking, kind of? Yeah. So the way I like to think about it is that, yeah, if I've maybe been interacting with a colleague or a spouse or a sibling, right, in a pretty established way, if I show up and start speaking in this way, they might be like, who the hell are you, right? So at the outset, a tool that I will often talk about that is not part of this talk, it's called neutral self-observation narrative self-observation. And that is actually naming what you're thinking as it's happening. So an example might be, I'm realizing that as we're talking about this, I'm starting to get frustrated. Can we pause this conversation and come back at a later time? So in the context of asking, right, starting to introduce some of these questions into how you're communicating with others, you could say something like, I attended this really great talk at a conference that I went to, and I learned a lot of things, and I'm wondering if it would be cool if I start, right, asking these questions of you, or saying, this might be new for you to hear, but I want to try this out. If it lands, cool. If not, also cool. So just kind of narrating out loud, cluing the other person in to what's happening in your own thought process, that can be helpful. Does that answer your question a little bit? Yeah? Okay, cool. I saw more, I thought. Were there more questions? Yeah, go ahead. The last slide back up. This one? Yeah. Amazing. Yes.
I think one thing that I've
Yeah, so the question was when we are stressed, which for most of us is all the time, because we're in a period of chronic stress in human history right now. How can we engage with these tools in a stress response? So that is also a whole other talk. For right now, what I would offer is that if I know my emotional setting is kind of already up here, or something happens that causes me to maybe get extra stressed out, there are physical things, right, like taking a deep breath in the moment. But I think what I would actually do is going back to that narrative self-observation piece. Anytime I can clue the other person in to where I'm at, right? So I might say, like, you know what? I haven't had breakfast yet this morning. I had a really stressful commute. I would love to have this conversation, but I'm going to need a couple minutes, right? It can feel like we're, you know, I've heard people say like, oh, that's making an excuse, or like, oh, that whatever. What it ends up doing is being more honest and straightforward about what's going on, right? I need a couple minutes. And for real, I have these golden questions on post-it notes all around my office. Like, I forget and I teach it. So patience for yourself as well. And we've got just a couple minutes. Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good question. So the question was, if you are someone who maybe is prone to over-communicating or talking a lot, and you're wanting to get responses from someone who maybe isn't as much of a talker and just likes straightforward bits. So I think if I go back to reflective practice and that self-awareness that you're demonstrating so beautifully, right? If I know I'm an over-communicator, I am. You'll be shocked to know. What I will often do, actually, is try to make some space for different kinds of communication. My spouse happens to be somebody who actually is not an over-communicator, much more direct. He's a professional engineer. So actually, something that has worked well for us is if I know that I'm going to want to, like, talk about it, and he maybe won't right away, I have a journal, and I will just kind of like, blah, 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 right, just like talk and put all of my content in writing, or I will talk to myself as I'm driving, as I try to kind of figure out ways I want to say it. So I'm narrowing down in my own head what I want to say. Another thing that's actually really helpful is to not underestimate communicating in writing. A lot of times when we run into communication bumps in real time and we're using verbal speech, that's really challenging for a lot of folks, especially in stress responses, right? Verbal communication can be challenging. So if I am able to do something in writing, right? Maybe it's in a text, maybe it's an email, sometimes even talking over the phone, I think a lot of times communication in writing gets kind of put aside as being less personal. But if I know that the person in front of me maybe is going to want things a little more concrete, communication in writing can be really valuable. And then the other thing I had thought of as well was the idea that if you know that you want to kind of talk through something, having one or two humans in your life who also are verbal processors or like to process out loud, link up, right? Maybe have that relationship with another person so you can kind of talk it out with consent, of course, right? Not oversharing. And then going back to the other person once you've kind of gotten through bits, but those are some strategies that come to mind right away. I think we just, yeah, one more. Yeah, yep, things in writing, outline structure. Yeah, that's actually something I do too, now that you're bringing it up. I have a coworker who does not like talking and also likes a lot of context and background information, but also just wants the bottom line. So when I email her, it's bottom line at the top. I say, like, here is one sentence, what has to happen? And then I have context, and I underline it, and then give bullet point content. Yes, genius, yes, yes, amazing. One more, I think. Do we have time? Yes? Okay, gorgeous. Amazing. One more question. Yeah.
Have you run into situations where you have said,
You mean, do I work at a college? Yeah, so if I'm understanding what you're asking, right, folks who maybe are used to communicating behind a screen, and so then in person, the reactions might be a little less appropriate? Kinda? Sure. So then is the question how to maybe address the rudeness or abrasiveness in writing? Sure. I think actually it might sound a little counterintuitive, but in my experience with students, if that person is used to communicating in writing, I'm going to keep communicating in writing. The couple of times I have tried to approach a student who is, did you say keyboard warrior? I love that. And then I try to approach them in person, absolutely not. Right, like it tends to make it worse. So what I'll do instead is introduce the concern or like what questions I maybe have for why or how they're responding that way and do that in writing first and then see, right, if I can address it in writing, amazing. If also interacting in person is just going to maybe be better for me, cool. But since I know, one thing that didn't come up in this is power dynamics and privilege, right? The idea being that like if you have privileged identities or in a position of power, responsibility is on you, right? To take the, not be the bigger person, but meet the other person where they're at in terms of where the comfort level is first, and then kind of adjust or course correct if need be. That's a tricky one. There's a lot we could go into there. Yeah. Yeah, of course. I think that might be all that we have time for, but thank you all so much again. Really appreciate it. Thank you.